I don't know if I'd say there's moments that I thought that we made a mistake, but definitely moments when you wanted to walk away. I feel like I'm missing like the fear gene in my life. I mean, I moved to El Salvador when I had the highest murder rate in the world. I never felt afraid. Having the right argument or having the right facts or being right doesn't necessarily convince people of something. Like price-wise?
Yes.
Well, I always like to say one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin, but...
Yeah, you're not going to get away with that.
Sure. 1,000. Thanks for all your great questions. I've done a lot of podcasts, but none that made me think this hard. So I love that.
All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Welcome to All in Bitcoin, Mike. I'm excited to talk to you about Bitcoin and beyond. But first, let's get to know you a little bit better with my 21 takes on you. Ready?
Perfect.
What did you want to be as a kid?
I think I wanted to be a stockbroker as a kid.
Really?
I was always very interested in finance.
That's interesting. Most people say astronaut.
Yeah. I mean, of course, I wanted to be a professional surfer, you know, but as far as things that were more realistic, yeah, I've always been interested in finance.
What were you into back then?
I loved surfing since a young age. Probably went surfing for the first time when I was like 3 years old. So I grew up in San Clemente in Southern California and walking distance to the beach. And so, yeah, from a very young age, it was kind of my passion would be to
Your
to
father
go to the
was
beach.
A surfer?
My father was a surfer. I remember, you know, back then it was normal for parents to let their kids, you know, go to the beach when they were 9, 10 years old by themselves. And so from a young age, I would like go down and go surfing by myself. And you couldn't do that today, that they'd take your kids away from you. But I'm glad I grew up during the 80s. So,
what did you feel about school?
I always enjoyed school. I, you know, like any kid, you complain about it, but I always did well in school. I was always a good student. I was top of my class. And so I enjoyed it. I had a tendency to push my teachers out of their comfort zone. I was always asking them the unexpected questions that they didn't have the answers for.
How did you discover El Salvador?
Came to El Salvador on a surf trip, and it was kind of a whim. Me and a buddy wanted to go on a trip, and they had cheap tickets to El Salvador at that time. I knew there was warm water, and I'd never been to El Salvador before, so we bought tickets and no plans, no rental car, no place to stay. We just showed up and made our way and wound up staying in El Tunco, which is just down the road from where I live now in El Zante.
Was it the first country you traveled to outside the U.S.?
No, I had been quite a prolific traveler. I did a program through my university that we spent time in like 9 different countries in Europe. And then after I graduated, I spent about a year with 3 buddies that we traveled all around the whole world. And we went to like 20 different countries during that time, like everything from driving down to Guatemala till we were like in the far north of Russia. We traveled across India by train. And we were kind of all over.
So what made it stand out for you?
El Salvador was the first place that I've been in the world where I really felt like I could live here. Like a lot of places you go, you know, the people are super friendly, but it's because they're trying to sell you something. They're kind of in your face. They're always trying to be your best friend. And it's, you feel like you can't just relax and be on your own. Or on the opposite end, you feel like they're kind of cold and unfriendly and, you know, not that engaging. In El Salvador, I felt like there was a great mix. Like if you wanted to interact with the people, they're very friendly. They'd help you out, not just because they're trying to like sell you something. They just genuinely want to help you out. But if you just wanted to be left alone, people would leave you alone. And so I felt like, wow, this is an amazing place. The beautiful beaches, easy plane ride from the U.S., same time zone. So I felt like, wow, this kind of ticks all the boxes.
What do you feel El Salvador saved you from?
I think El Salvador saved me from boredom and from kind of slipping into a normal life.
And what did Bitcoin save you from?
I wouldn't say Bitcoin saved me from anything, but I think it allowed me to pursue the things that I was really passionate about. And it provided answers to questions I had, like, why do we have this financial system that works, you know, for some people in the world and for other people it doesn't work? It seems very unfair. And so for me, Bitcoin was kind of the answer to a lot of questions I had of, like, why have we adopted this broken financial system? And Bitcoin was the system that actually worked.
What's your definition of a Bitcoiner?
My definition of a Bitcoiner is somebody who has opted out of the fiat world, that is not into Bitcoin just because they want to eventually sell it for more fiat. Like, they are in Bitcoin for the freedom aspect of it, not just the number go up. They're not going to move from Bitcoin to something else if it looks like it can make them more fiat. They are in Bitcoin because they believe that it kind of levels the playing field for everybody. They're passionate about the fact that it gets rid of intermediaries and that there's no permission needed in it, that anybody can participate.
What was an average Sunday like for you as a kid?
An average Sunday, we would usually go to church with my family. Mm-hmm. We'd go to the beach or go do something else with the family. It was usually a family day.
The latest thing you learned about yourself?
I think that I've learned this past few years that I'm ADHD. I never would have thought that I would define myself as that, because I was always a great student and always did well in school. But just realizing that that's the way that my mind works, that I've also realized that I just see the world very differently than most people do. And so I have to be patient when people don't understand what I'm talking about, because a lot of times I just come at it from a very different direction than they do.
And the lesson that's taken you the longest to learn?
Having the right argument or having the right facts or being right doesn't necessarily convince people of something. That a lot of people are more guided by their emotions or their feeling that you're seeing them. And so I've had to try to learn how to talk to people differently, and where I've always liked to be very combative, and that's not because I don't like somebody, but I like that kind of going back and forth, and I like to be proven wrong so I can learn something new and change. But I've just realized that a lot of people don't like that, and so that you have to adjust your style of interaction with people depending on what works for them.
What do you wish more people knew about you?
I don't know. I feel like I like being behind the scenes in things. I don't like being out front in the role and the things, the opportunities that have come up with Bitcoin Beach and the things that have happened. I've often needed to be that front person, needed to be the one on TV or on camera, which I'm okay with, but I actually prefer to be behind the scenes.
What part of you needed to rebel against the system, and where does that come from?
I feel like every part of me needed to rebel against the system. Yeah, I've always just been rebellious. If there was rules, I needed them explained to me. I couldn't obey rules just because they were the rules. I needed to understand the rationale behind them. And so, yeah, I feel like I've always kind of wanted to push the envelope.
And where does that come from?
Probably in my family, yeah. I think my dad and my grandfather are both kind of like that. We have this kind of rebel streak that runs through my family, especially on my dad's side.
Why do you think Bitcoiners fight so much?
I think Bitcoiners fight so much because they're very idealistic. They come into this feeling that it's very, very important. And so they're not going to compromise on something that they think is that important. So I think that's the good side of it. I would say on the negative side, I think a lot of Bitcoiners put too much importance on Bitcoin. It has become their life, the only thing they ever think about, and it's become kind of like a god to them. And I think if you look to Bitcoin to fulfill that role, I think that you're going to be found wanting. And so I think it makes them want to fight about things. At the end of the day, Bitcoin's still just money. I mean, it's the world's best money and it solves a lot of issues, but it's still just money. And so if you make money all your life's about, I think you're going to be empty.
How did you meet your wife?
I met my wife in university. So freshman year, we were in a small college in Santa Barbara, Westmont College, and we had kind of these small little cottage dorms. So it was like, they had a dorm, I think it was like 20 guys in one dorm and 20 girls in the one next door. And so we became actually best friends for like 3 years before we started dating our senior year. So
what did you study at the university?
I studied economics.
Tell me a personal goal or dream you're still chasing.
Yeah, that's a hard one to answer because I feel like even in everything I've wanted to do in life, I've been able to do. Not that I still don't dream, and but I feel that, I've been privileged to not have any regrets. Everything I've wanted to pursue, I've pursued. My life has been a little bit different. I would like to build we're kind of pushing to see a wave park built in El Salvador. And so I would love to be a part of that. I guess that would be a goal that I still have. So
okay.
To see one of the top world wave parks built in El Salvador.
That's great. The most unforgettable eye-opening story you've ever witnessed or experienced?
Yeah. I feel like I've had the opportunity to experience so many different things, but I think maybe going back to the genesis of Bitcoin Beach and the way that it was started in such an improbable way that there was a donor that wanted to donate without any recognition, that just wanted to see this Bitcoin circular economy come into being. And I came to him with a very half-ass plan. We were given that opportunity, and that everything that we hoped to have happen like came into being, and even more so. So that somebody that didn't want any recognition, that had no desire other than that to change the world, was able to make all this happen.
That's pretty incredible.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. A lost opportunity.
I think the only lost opportunity I would really say, which is kind of like an ongoing one for me, I would say, is my physical health. I feel like there's so much in life when you're very active there are trade-offs. And so I think I don't think I'd really do anything different in my life other than try to, you know, make sure that I was more disciplined in getting out surfing and in my health, and not let, you know, other great opportunities get in the way with that. Cause I think it's you need to have a balance in that. And that's one thing I've been focused on right now, is trying to get that back in line.
Do you surf regularly now?
I have not been lately. I've been just cause I've been traveling and doing so much, but that's.
When was the last time you surfed?
Probably a month ago.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the goal though for this year. We had a lot of things going. My son was graduating. We had family in town. We've had a lot of things happening, but my kids are both going to be in school, and my wife and I will be empty nesters. And so we're looking forward to just really focusing on health in this next year.
Your greatest asset?
I'm not wired to need to take credit for things. Like, I don't care to be recognized. I don't care about that. And I feel like it helps me get things done, because anytime you're willing to give other people a credit, they're willing to help you on things. And so I think I'm able to move and to make things happen because I'm happy to give other people the credit.
What's Bitcoin's biggest enemy?
I think people only seeing it as digital gold, for them not embracing the freedom aspect of it. And I don't think that we really use Bitcoin as freedom technology unless we're using it as money. And so if it just becomes another financial asset that's locked up by all the wealthy people in the world, that Bitcoin is never going to be what it could really be. And it's not going to have that equalizing force on the world.
Do you think that's a lost battle?
No, I actually think that we are winning on that. I think specifically as we're seeing these circular Bitcoin economies spring up around the world, I think people are realizing that the use cases that the people in the developing world have for Bitcoin are very different than this like investment, HODL, number go up focus that, you know, a lot of Americans and Europeans have. And so I think that we're actually winning the battle on that. I'm hoping, you know, there's potential legislation in the U.S. right now that will actually allow people to not have to track the tax implications of their Bitcoin for, I think it's for purchases up to $600. And so I think if we see that law change, I think you'll see even in the U.S. this new experience of people realizing just how great it is to use Bitcoin as money. So I think that's one thing that's been holding it back right now.
What's a fear you faced and overcome?
I'm not really, I feel like I'm missing like the fear gene in my life. Like, I mean, I moved to El Salvador when I had the highest murder rate in the world. I never felt afraid while we were here. So I don't feel like I have that type of fear. I mean, I'd say my biggest fear is just going in the social situations where it's just a bunch of small talk and you just have to make boring conversations with people. I'm very fearful of those environments. So.
And what about talking at conferences in front of thousands of people?
Yeah, I don't mind being up front. I'm not energized. Some people love being in the spotlight. They love being up on stage and it energizes them. It doesn't energize me. I mean, it still feels like work, but I'm not fearful of it. I much prefer panels or you know, fireside chats, that type of thing, rather than doing a standalone presentation on something. But I'm not fearful of the crowds, but I prefer smaller group interactions. And so I don't like the time after you speak where then you have to make small talk with people and it's this awkward, like, you know, people want to come up and talk to you, but they don't really know what to say. And yeah, so that's the thing that's for me. And I love people. I love meeting people, but it's still, I'm an introvert. So that type of thing kind of drains me sometimes.
You are an introvert.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Me too. But how do you force yourself to do interviews all the time and to go to conferences?
Yeah, I just understand the importance of it. I know the importance of media. Like I said, I don't love seeing myself on TV or love, you know, seeing pictures of myself, but I understand the importance of it. And so whenever I can find somebody else that can take that role, I'd much rather push them into it. So we have Roman or Chimbera, some people know him on our team, who's good with things. So whenever I can push him to do it. But I know it's important. And so for me, I'm willing to do that. Even at conferences, you know, I know the importance of that. And I really do enjoy getting to know people one-on-one or in small groups. But like at a conference, you'll see me, I'll come down for a while and then I'll go back up to my hotel room and recharge. Or if I don't have a hotel room, I'll go out to my car and just sit in my car for like an hour and just kind of like recharge and then come back out. So for me, it's work. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing, Mike. I feel that we know you a little bit better. So let's talk about Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I love those questions. I've never had somebody ask things like that before. So I think that's a great format.
Thank you. So what's your Bitcoin story?
So I started reading articles about Bitcoin very early on. You know, I'd say in 11, 12, you'd see, I think there was like a mention in the Wall Street Journal talking about this new money that no state or government could control. And, you know, I've always been, you know, a libertarian. Ayn Rand was one of my favorite authors, like, you know, since I was like in junior high. And so I've always been fascinated about, you know, how do we take control away from the state? And so when I started hearing about Bitcoin, I was fascinated for that reason. It did also sound like it was kind of like a Ponzi scheme at the same time. And I didn't understand like how you could have digital scarcity and, you know, what would actually give Bitcoin its value. So in some ways I was intrigued, but in other ways, you know, I had a lot of questions, I think like a lot of people. And, you know, I kept following it. I followed the prices, except kept moving up in price. I was like, oh, this might have legs. But I've never been like a real tech person. So when I tried to buy Bitcoin at that time, it was very challenging. You know, I was talking about keywords and I think that time you needed to send funds to Mt. Gox in Japan. And yeah, and it was, and then like store it on your computer. And it was just kind of like overwhelming to me. And so I more followed it just like on the theoretical side. And then when it got easy to buy, I can't remember if it was 16 or 17 when you could go on Coinbase and it was easier to buy. That was when I actually bought Bitcoin.
Okay. From all the interviews you've hosted, which guest or story surprised you the most and why? There have been a few.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say, so there's a guy named Brendan who lives in Uganda that they're working with an orphanage and a school there in Uganda, and seeing how they have used Bitcoin in that setting where nobody around them was using it. Like, they truly started this circular Bitcoin economy from scratch and in a environment that was even tougher than what we saw happen in El Salvador. And so just seeing the excitement in his eyes, like, as when we sat down to do a podcast, I knew him and had some interactions with him before that, but just seeing, you know, that kind of vision that he could change his country. And I've seen that in numerous others too, but I would say that's the one that just pops into my mind right now.
Do you notice a common trait or mindset across most Bitcoiners?
Yeah, I think most Bitcoiners are people that they see the world differently. I mean, they've always, you know, they'll tell you their stories and their different things. They've always been kind of pushing the envelope. They've always looked at things a little differently. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, I would say are neurodivergent or a little bit on the spectrum. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And I think that's kind of a superpower for them. It helps them to see things in a way that other people don't, and to question the status quo of super smart, you know, people with PhDs. They don't question why the dollar has value or why we think 2% inflation is a positive thing. And so I think that people that are just wired a little bit differently.
What's something you learned as a podcast host that you wish you'd known earlier?
I wish that I would have taken the time earlier in life to get to know more people that maybe didn't have the same interest as me, that ran in different circles than me. That's one of the great things about being a podcast host, is you get to sit down with people that you might never interact with, and, you know, outside of that. And you get to ask them personal questions, you get to know things, and you get to see, you know, side of them that other people don't. And so I really enjoy that. I really learning from people. And so that's one thing that it's taught me, to like take advantage of the time that I have with people to really hear their opinions on things.
What's something Bitcoiners still don't understand about life in El Salvador?
A lot of Bitcoiners see the world like very black and white. And so they think it's like, oh, either Bitcoin is like a huge success or it's a failure. And you can have, it's funny, you can have people in one group and some of them will be like shocked with how many places you can use Bitcoin, and others in that same group will be disappointed because they thought, you know, nobody used the dollar anymore and it would only be Bitcoin. And so I think Bitcoiners need to look at things through the lens of history and realize that, you know, when we read about revolutions in the history books, like, they seem like they happened overnight, but really they often take decades to kind of work their way out. Even if maybe the crucial events happened within a few years, there was a lot of things leading up to it, and there was time coming out of it that really like set something in place. And so I think Bitcoiners need to see things in decade time spans rather than like, okay, it's been 2 years and not everybody's using Bitcoin, so it's not a success. So that would be the thing I'd say, like, people need to lower their time preference and realize that this is something that is inevitable, but it's going to take more time than they maybe think.
You would say that Bitcoiners, we are good at that, low time preference and all.
I think in some ways Bitcoiners are, but in other ways they're not. Like, they want things to happen overnight, and sometimes they're very rigid. You know, we've seen this more recently with the number of Bitcoiners that have soured on El Salvador because of the deal with the IMF. Like, they don't see that you know, there's always like these two steps forward, one step back as you have these transitions. And governments have a lot of different things that they're, you know, they have to focus on, not just Bitcoin. And so I think 10 years from now, it'll be clear to everybody that, oh yeah, that was just kind of a blip. But for a lot of Bitcoiners, they get disillusioned very easily. And so they're like, no, this isn't working. And so, yeah, that's the thing that I think Bitcoiners need to lower their time preference, like in all things in life.
Why do you think El Salvador is still under a state of emergency, even when the U.S. ranks it as one of the safest places to travel to?
I think there is a big hesitancy for people to call the victory too early. There's, you know, a long history, even in El Salvador, of them having a crackdown on the gangs and it bringing crime down for quite a bit of time. And then things kind of backing off and it going back to business as usual, or sometimes the gangs would come back even stronger. And so there's been a lot of huge sacrifices that had to be made to see the progress that we've had so far. And so I think that in their mind, the risk reward of backing off too early, the risk is much higher than the cost of like, okay, let's just keep this status until we know that we're 100% where we want to be and that it's been long enough so that all the gang networks have been broken, that it can't ever go back to how it'd be before. And, you know, personally, I would love to see the government, you know, reverse tomorrow and to basically call off the state of emergency. But, you know, I also know that they have responsibilities and burdens that, you know, that I don't. And so, it's a challenging thing.
For those who don't know Bitcoin Beats, can you briefly explain to us what it is, how it started, and what it offers to the community in El Zonte?
Yeah, so Bitcoin Beach was really just a project to integrate Bitcoin into existing social projects that we had going on in El Zonte. And the idea was to expand them for the whole region. That's why we called it Bitcoin Beach. We hoped the whole coast would take it on. And a lot of those programs were focused on keeping young people out of the gangs. And so there were educational initiatives, after-school programs, you know, paying them to clean the rivers or the beaches, paying them in Bitcoin. And that kind of served two things. It gave us the ability to spend time with these kids, invest in their lives. It kept them from, you know, getting in trouble. But it also, they're getting paid in Bitcoin. And so for the first time in their life, they started thinking about, okay, why is Bitcoin money? Why does the value go up and down? They start doing their own research and they start questioning fiat money, and it helps them think about, the time value of money, and that if they make sacrifices now, they will actually have more benefit in the future. It lowers their time preference, and that kind of spills over into everything. Education. We've seen kids that start thinking, well, before, all they wanted to do was get out of school and work, and why would they go on to high school or university when they would have to sacrifice making a wage now? All of a sudden, they're thinking, well, yes, I'm going to have to sacrifice a wage now, but I'll get to make more in the future with this education, and I'll be able to do something that I enjoy more. And so it helps lower their time preference in all areas. And so, yeah, so that was what Bitcoin Beach was focused on. And then, you know, obviously, as El Salvador adopted Bitcoin as legal tender, it kind of spread through the rest of El Salvador. And now we're working with close to 100 communities around the world, probably in 50 different countries, specifically, you know, in the developing, global south predominantly, and seeing these kind of small communities transform the regions around them, kind of in the same way that Bitcoin Beach did in El Salvador.
Can you share a moment when you saw the ideas of Bitcoin Beach white paper really working in the community, and what changes surprised you most?
So yeah, I would say there's a few different moments, but mostly seeing people, they revolve around seeing people save for the first time in their life, because El Salvador historically has not had a culture of saving or thinking about the future. It's kind of, you make your money today, you spend it today. And, you know, you talk to people about that and they'd always tell you, oh, well, that's because we earn so little and we don't have that ability. But we saw as we started paying people in Bitcoin, they did actually start saving, even though they're making the same amount in fiat terms. If they were thinking about, well, I don't want to spend this now because I think it'll be worth more in the future. That really surprised me, was how much just using Bitcoin and moving off a fiat standard onto a Bitcoin standard shapes people's ability to save.
Was there ever a moment when you thought you've made a mistake and wanted to walk away?
I don't know if I'd say there's moments that I thought that we'd made a mistake, but definitely moments when you wanted to walk away. There's the challenges of seeing people that lose the keys or lose access to their wallet, and even though you've tried to, you know, talk to them about the importance of these things, see them like kind of go through that struggle and have saved up money and to lose access to that. It was challenging, especially in bear markets when people are like, you know, they haven't really gone through it before. And I think all Bitcoiners go through this, their first bear market. And so they're like upset with you that, you know, you lied to them or you're a scammer because this just keeps going down. And so, you know, just trying to walk with them and explain, you know, we always tell people to, you know, to not speculate, to not, you know, especially in up markets, you see people, they want to like sell a property and put it in Bitcoin. We're like, no, don't do that. Just continue to save and accumulate and then hopefully be able to buy a property with what you're accumulating. Like it's, so the bear markets can be hard and then, you know, just the normal things for Bitcoiners when they lose their keys or they don't handle their security problem. But those turn into teaching moments and usually people recover from those and then are much better off in the future because they learn those lessons early on.
And how do you deal with the weight of hope and expectations that people place on you, especially when you know that you cannot fix everything?
We just have to be honest with people and say, hey, we're a small team. We have limited bandwidth and we're not going to be able to do everything. We try to set expectations of like, yeah, we can do these small projects, we can do educational initiatives, but you know, we're not going to be building hospitals or universities or, you know, doing those sorts of things. You know, we believe those things will come as the country improves, as the wealth kind of flows into El Salvador. I mean, we've seen all these businesses that are locating here. We're seeing all these investors that are coming in and bringing money. So those things will come, but that's not our job. We're just focused on like grassroots community efforts.
Do you think Bitcoin Beach has been successful?
Yeah, I think it's had a huge impact on El Zante, where we live, on the community there. Improved, you know, numerous families' lives through the opportunities that have come in. I think that it's put El Salvador on the map. I mean, you look at the amount of media focus from, you know, 60 Minutes to Forbes to Bloomberg, you know, all these articles, and even the ones that are negative have pictures of the beautiful beaches of El Salvador. And so it's drawn in tourists, and the tourism's booming. And it's also made Salvadorans, I think, proud of being Salvadoran. They used to in the past be almost kind of embarrassed. And now they're like, no, our country is like on the cutting edge and we're in the newspapers all the time. And obviously a huge part of that is Bukele has become, you know, a leader that people all around the world like look up to. And so, you know, there's a lot of different reasons for it, but it's fun to think that, you know, Bitcoin Beach played a small role in kind of setting things on that path. El Salvador's important now in the world. People didn't used to care at all about El Salvador. It was only like the butt of jokes before, where now people care what's happening here.
What drew you to focus so much of your energy on El Zante instead of your community back in the States?
I think that my community back in the States, for one thing, doesn't have the extreme need that we had in El Zante. You know, the people that have access to better jobs, better schooling, to more opportunities. And so, to be honest, I think Bitcoin's needed less in my community in the US than it's needed in El Salvador, because everybody there has bank accounts, they have credit cards, they have things that are definitely not as good as Bitcoin, but I think that they are good enough for most people to not be willing to get out of their comfort zone and engage with Bitcoin. And so I think there's something kind of poetic about the fact that Bitcoin is really being used money more in the global south than it is in the developed world, because it's kind of leveling the playing field that hasn't been leveled because it was created by the powers that be to benefit them. And so now we have this new technology, this new money that makes it even for everybody. And so I think it's important to see it playing out in places like El Zante.
The question comes from this. As of 2024, approximately 6% of US households were unbanked, equating to about 8 million households. This is according to the latest Fed's 2024 report. So there are people in need, as we know, in Europe and in the States. But do you ever feel torn, because we could focus on
I think different people are called to be in different places. You know, I was actually living in El Salvador, you know, prior to even Bitcoin being invented. And so, you know, I already had a heart for El Salvador at that time. And so for me, it was the natural place. And actually the projects that, you know, became Bitcoin Beach didn't actually start out as a Bitcoin project. It was just a community project, you know, focused on keeping young people out of the gangs. And so, for me and my family, we were called to be, you know, there during that time. For other people, that's what we always tell people, like, you don't need to move somewhere else to do something, like do something where you're at, because you already have the trust and the relationships there. And so if you're in the US and you see that in your community, then yeah, you should start it there. That's going to be the most natural place to do it.
The white paper talks about kids needing their love tank filled. What filled yours when you were a kid?
I would say primarily my family. I had was very close with my parents and my brother and two sisters. We had a very loving family. I feel that was a little bit of the exception, you know, compared to, you know, other people I know and stories I've heard from them growing up. But I had just parents that really poured into me, and I think gave me a sense of confidence that I could do anything. And then also on a greater level, like my beliefs in God and the church that I participated, that I was part of. So growing up in a Christian church and believing that we have a greater purpose here on earth, not to serve ourselves, but to serve those around us.
Why do you think so many Bitcoiners say that Bitcoin reflects Christian values like honesty, responsibility?
I think because the way that it's designed and the way that it's built, it can't be used unfairly by those in powerful positions. So Michael Saylor can't use Bitcoin any better to his benefit than, you know, a construction laborer in El Zante. They still have access. The rules are still the same for them. The access is still the same. They don't need permission from anybody. And so I think that taking it back to a level playing field, and I think that reflects, you know, God's desire for humanity is for the poor to have the same rights as the wealthy. And I think our current system doesn't allow for that. So I think that that's how it reflects Christian values, and that it's a equal playing field for everybody.
Am I right to say that before Bitcoin Beach, you were already involved in Christian projects in El Salvador?
Yeah. So we first bought a house in, I think it was 2005, in El Salvador. And we would just come down here for a few months each year to surf and to hang out. And during that time, we started attending a church in San Salvador and getting to know a lot of missionaries and people that were running children's homes or working with women who had been victims of sex trafficking or working with drug addicts. And so we saw a bunch of different families and started getting to know them, and then seeing what a challenging environment it was for them to serve in, had the highest murder rate in the world. In fact, one of my best friends now, he got shot in the neck here. his car was ambushed and he got shot in the neck. And so hearing their family story and seeing all these things, my wife and I decided, hey, we can move down to El Salvador and support all these different missionaries and people working in these NGOs and help them with like their family needs, with their need for counseling, their need for time of respite. And so we developed a couple guest homes that they could use up to 10 nights a year that they could, you know, a lot of them were serving like in the middle of gang territory. Their kids couldn't go outside. And so this was a place they could go and have time on their own. And then once a year, we would bring professional counselors down from the U.S. to do trauma counseling. And we would do a retreat to kind of bring them all together so that they could, you know, help each other with best practices and work together. And so, yeah, so this was all stuff that we were doing for many years before the Bitcoin aspect came into play.
What Bible verse or story do you think best captures the spirit of Bitcoin Beats?
I wouldn't say that there's like a specific verse or story, but I believe that we were created for this purpose to be here on earth and that the Bible is an instruction manual for that. And I think that the reason that we benefit so much from serving others and investing in others is that's how we're created. We're created to have our greatest fulfillment in that. And the great thing about Bitcoin is it helps us be much more efficient in impacting people's lives. There's a lot of people that have good hearts and that really want to invest in others, but they, you know, they don't have the right tools. And in the end, they don't make that big of an impact. And so we've seen how some crazy little teeny project in El Zante like blew up into this thing that's transformed El Salvador and then is like spiraled throughout the world. It's nothing to do with me or the team. I mean, we had very small vision, but I think the tool of Bitcoin allows us to, you know, to expand.
I think it has something to do with you.
Well, I mean, obviously you have to be willing to, you know, to do what you feel you're called to do, but at the same time, there's people that, you know, if you were just picking somebody to do something, there's people that are much more skilled than me that, you know, could have been chosen, but it, you know, it all came together for a purpose.
What's something you have changed your mind about since starting Bitcoin Beats?
Man, you got some hard questions. I think one thing I've changed my mind about is that there's like a right and wrong way to do things. I've seen that really there's lots of different ways to go about having an impact. And so I think that's what's so great about the way Bitcoin is designed, it's decentralized. And so you don't have this top down, like there's one specific way to best have an impact. And so we're seeing now there's all these other, you know, communities springing up, like you see Berlin, and now in Punta Mongo, there's La Paria. There's a lot of different.
Punta Mongo is where you started.
Yeah, the very, very beginning. We kind of started, and then we shifted to El Zante, and now we're seeing like big movement in Punta Mongo again. You see that there's not like a necessarily right and wrong way, and yeah, I like seeing it done by different people in different ways rather than it being like this top down, where I would have thought before, like, okay, we need to have this formula and, you know, we teach everybody how to do it. And the way it's happened has been more organic of people take bits and learnings of what we've done. They use the white paper, but then they make changes that work better in their community. And then a lot of times they'll feedback to us like, hey, we're doing this and it's really working. And then we can integrate that in our project.
To wrap things up, imagine it's 100 years from now and Bitcoin Beach is more legend than memory. What legacy do you hope to leave behind in El Zante and beyond?
I would hope that in 100 years, like people would look back on this was the turning point where the financial system no longer like controlled people and was the for the benefit of just a few. Like this was the time where fairness kind of came into the system and that El Salvador was an example to the rest of the world. That would be the dream that, you know, in the history books, people would point to El Salvador as how they showed that if it could happen here, if we could bring a system that was, you know, still very capitalistic, but in a way that everybody was on the same playing field, and that that truly brought the benefits of capitalism in its true form to the rest of the world and kind of freed people from the system now that's very corrupted.
And last, it's the end of 2026, deep in the bear market, and you haven't sold Assad. What was the top?
Like price-wise?
Yes.
Well, I always like to say one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin, but...
Yeah, you're not going to get away with that.
Sure. 250,000. But I will have been spending Bitcoin all along because that's all we have. So yeah, we'll be spending Bitcoin all along.
Thanks for everything you're doing, Mike. And thanks for taking the time to share it with us. I've learned a lot from this conversation. Where can people follow you and your work?
We'd love for people to check out our podcast, the Live from Bitcoin Beach. Also on Twitter or X, it's just Bitcoin Beach. So love for people to follow and interact. And then obviously come to El Zante and come to El Salvador, spend some time here and spend your sats when you come.
It's been amazing having you on the pod. I can't wait to have you back. Thank you. Thank you for coming all the way to San Salvador to record this episode.
No, thanks for all your great questions. I've done a lot of podcasts, but none that made me think this hard. So I love that.